Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Thanks so much for hanging with us for all these years and all these interviews, and also for supporting the Wellington Square Bookshop. It's one of those COVID paradoxes where we're actually doing better now than we were before, and I really appreciate your support. Today, our guest is Nick Mamatas. He's the author of several novels, including I Am Providence, Sabbath, and the forthcoming The Second Shooter. His short fiction has appeared in Best American Mystery Stories, the year's best science fiction, fantasy, and many other venues. The best of the last decade was recently collected in the People's Republic of Everything. Nick is also an editor and anthologist. His forthcoming Title Wonder and Glory Forever collects classic and recent awe-inspiring Lovecraftian, which is amazing, fiction. Nick's fiction and editorial work has won a Bram Stoker Award, has been nominated for the Hugo, the World Fantasy Award, Locus, and Shirley Jackson Awards. And I'm old enough that Shirley Jackson, yeah, I get, but there's like 60% of what Nick does that maybe I don't know anything about, because as I said, as old as I am, I always thought when I was a kid, when I was 25, I'd stay ahead of the technological curve. And I did for a while. I mean, I networked my entire law office with RJ11 back in 1978. And I thought I was so cool. I had a laser writer that cost $8,000. And I was flipping 256K disks, spending most of my day just pulling them in and out of a Macintosh slot. Yeah, that was 1984, March. It was signed, but my Macintosh was signed by Steve Jobs. Anyway, enough about that. Welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Before we begin the show proper, let's talk a little bit about the esteemed company that you joined in this 26th edition. And we're going to get all of them at the bookstore and put them out front. But talk a little bit about the esteemed company you joined when you started your project here in the Outspoken Authors series.
Sure. So the Outspoken Authors series is edited by Terry Bisson, a pretty famous science fiction writer and editor. It is a little almost chapbook-sized, novella-sized books with authors who are politically engaged and also aesthetically engaged. So they've had legendary figures like Ursula K. Le Guin has a volume, Kim Stanley Robinson, Joe Lansdale, Elizabeth Hand. It's mostly science fiction and fantasy writers, though, of course, it had March Piercy, cultural commentators like Paul Krasner. And they're generally collections of short fiction, a piece of nonfiction, and a Q&A between the author and Terry Bisson. And a lot of them were friends of Terry Bisson's. That's why you can get a legendary figure to do a small short story collection with a small anarchist press that is published out of some guy's living room in Oakland, California. And so Terry's of a certain age, so most of his friends are of a certain age. So only in science fiction can you be in your late 40s and be one of the new writers, the new generation. And so here I am trying to lower the average age of the Outspoken Author series.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were talking before, you know, Rudy Rucker and Samuel Delaney and Michael Moorcock. These are guys that you and I both grew up with, and it's just, it's really cool that you got stuck in there. And the other thing that's interesting, it's funny how each cover is just a photograph of the author, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Michael Moorcock's on a camel or something. Isn't he like an Egypt on a camel? And Delaney's eating a sandwich or has a sandwich like this, and he's got a hat on, like he's just came from outside.
Yeah, you know, I always talk in each interview about, and I know my audience is sick and tired of hearing this, but because I own a bookstore and everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, well, pretty much everyone who walks in does. So these pictures, I think, will be really helpful because a lot of the people are recognizable. You know, there's three different sections of this book, and the main section, and what the title is The Planet Breaker's Son. And I guess the first question would be, well, two questions. What is RS, or real space, and What is a football arena size spaceship? Because you say football arena size 21 times in the book, which I kind of.
Well, just to give a little background, the Planet Breaker Stone is a novella. Because we were talking, as we were talking about, you have McGuinn and Michael Moorcock and Delaney, I knew I couldn't just put in a short story and some reprints. People want this book. So I wrote a whole novella to take up most of the book as sort of a value added proposition. And so the Planet Breaker Sun takes place after Earth is no longer habitable or no longer easily habitable, and people evacuate on a ship. But I'm not one of those science fiction people who believe that we're going to have spaceships full of meat like human beings. I think that it is going to ultimately be easier to just have our personalities recorded and emulated inside a spaceship, and our simulations will fly out into the deep space. And so I just balk at the idea of writing a spaceship full of people, so I wrote a spaceship full of personality emulators that create their own virtual world and their own existence inside the spaceship. And I figured just pure back of an envelope, not very good math. We had a few billion people, a few billion personalities emulated. How big would it need to be? And football field size sounds good, right?
Yeah.
Everything, football field size, or some fraction of it, or the width of a hair, or the price of a Starbucks coffee cup. That's how we measure everything on Earth these days.
Yeah, it's funny because the way it begins is, well, it begins with the Planet Breaker, although a good portion of the book is essentially devoted to the concept of the title. And it begins with this concept that, okay, we're not in real space, and the Planet Breaker has this job, avocation of picking up small black, I can see them in my head, which is so funny because a lot of this is happening in somebody's kind of head, and you can see the stone, and you can almost feel the smoothness of it. In my mind, it may not be.
Yeah.
And he tosses it, and he can destroy worlds. And he's Zeus, and his wife is Hera, the queen of the gods. And so I guess the question is, as a sci-fi aficionado since I was 12 years old, my mom would take me to the free library and I'd read Robert Heinlein and Ray Bradbury. Okay, it's like, okay, I understand this. But the question is, and the question maybe a reader who doesn't read this genre is, okay, how can this happen? And how can they be Zeus and Hera? Have they decided to adopt these personas just like they would put on clothing? What is it that allows them outside of this real space with cafeterias and crawlers outside the ship? What is it allows them to do this?
Well, it's kind of like the internet. I started on the internet when I was young, when I was 17 years old, before the web. And there were things called Tiny Muds, which were like chat-based programs that had sort of rooms. And they weren't rooms, they were just descriptions, but you could interact with them in a way that felt physical to a certain extent. If you were, you know, if your imagination was engaged by the text and you were typing and talking to other people. And of course, since then, we've had any number of virtual environments like a website, Second Life, chat rooms, Skype. These are all artificial environments, and they come and go. And some make a lot of sense, some make very little sense. And if you can try to imagine the topology of the internet, making a map of it, it would be impossible. Like, where is your website on the internet? It's somewhere. Where is Facebook? Well, it's everywhere. And so the virtual environment inside the spaceship that people live in now, because they don't have a physical existence anymore. They don't have themselves as programs, can be anything, which is why you basically need Planet Breakers to sort of clean up messes, to clean up planets that don't quite work, that don't quite make topological sense. But the nature of planet breaking is that whether or not something makes sense is entirely arbitrary and based on the whims of the Planet Breakers. So they're like a Greek god in this way. You know, the Greek gods were not beneficent, all fathers, like the one God, like God the Father, Christianity, or the Abrahamic, you know, Yahweh God. They were acquisitive, full of pique, sexualized, had their own agendas, they fought with each other, they had conflict with each other. And so, yeah, the couple are as we say, but they also are just a normal middle-class 21st century couple who act like this in here because they argue constantly, and they irritate each other a lot.
Yeah, and Zeus's grandparents, who, you know, Uranus is in the middle of a black hole, and, you know, not only were they fighting with each other, they would eat each other. They would eat each other and vomit them out and be tricked into vomiting them out. And so it's interesting the way you described the black hole, because, you know, I was thinking, I don't want to give away spoilers, but I don't know if this is even like a spoiler, but it kind of is. So if I do, just shut me up. But the idea is, you know, like, okay, they're inside this black hole. You talk about the event horizon. You talk about being flattened. The kid goes there, and, you know, he served all kinds of Greek coffee. Well, eventually he gets to drink Greek coffee, but he's served all kinds of little snacks that really aren't identified in Greek culture. It's just like, basically, it just says a snack.
It reminds me of that. A tray of snacks of various sorts. It can be.
Yeah. And so, okay, you combine the two things, and he gets flattened, but he's still in there. And I just wonder, again, if you're reading this, you're not reading it literally, but you're talking about two different things that are exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. Like Franz Kafka sitting at a plain deal table writing inside of a black hole. It's impossible. Yeah. Yet you describe it perfectly. Right. So what's the idea?
I guess the idea is that when you have a virtual world, it even if you try to make it like the real world, it'll break on certain levels. The way that code breaks, the way that if I have two rooms and on a tiny mud, I can connect those rooms to a mailbox. And so by entering the mailbox, I can end up in a room. Or like the Doctor Who's TARDIS. It's much bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. These are all impossible things. So I'm playing with time and space and with ideas and with the idea that we can make the world real again in a virtual environment. And I think we can't. I think we'll have limitations to it. I think we'll have people want to make it all real. We want to make it fanciful for our own entertainment and for our own social and maybe even religious purposes. And so I kept trying to combine the everyday life and the science fictional worlds.
And it's interesting.
Always is, oh, here's your conscious conceit, and how does it relate to the emotions of the characters?
Yeah, and it's interesting because you do it in that concrete fashion, but then you have him sitting there reading Dubliners and reading a specific story that deals with someone he can identify with. And that's really like throws you for a loop, because who's reading it? Because he becomes someone else. He's reading this book that I read that story and it affected me when I started collecting James Joyce as a book collector. And that whole book of short stories affected me. So where did that come from? Did it come from you as a child? Which I'm allowed to say, because in my mind, I'm incorporating you into this book. I'm just assuming you and I are both part of this book.
Yeah. Well, the story is Araby, which is one of the best stories in the English language. And I teach creative writing and often teach it as an example of an excellent short story. And in science fiction, James Joyce has a very low reputation because I haven't read him very much. And everyone always says, "Oh, I'm not one of those literary fancy pants like James Joyce. He stinks. I'm eating potatoes, rocket ships, and laser guns." And so I even made a friend of mine read the story 40 times. I said, "If you want to be a better writer, read the story 40 times over the weekend. You got a 3-day weekend, so read it over the course of 3 days, every few hours. Just go back and read it again." And he came back at that Monday. I was actually kind of half joking. I was surprised that he actually did it. But he did it. And he said, "Yeah, that story is great." After about 23 times, I got really interested in it and really excited about it. And so I find Araby just a very powerful story. And when we do leave the planet, one way or another, whether it's in spaceships or as personality emulators on some internet-style spaceship that's smaller, we're going to bring our culture with us. We're going to try to. And we'll bring bits and pieces of it, and we'll leave important things out, and we will bring trivial stuff with us. But I guess my sort of hope is that James Joyce will come with us.
It's funny because when I was in college and I majored in English literature, I took a James Joyce honor seminar. And when we were doing Ulysses, basically it was Ulysses. And so in the beginning, when it says stately, plump Buck Mulligan descended the staircase and all that, which is most people don't get past that. But I turned it into a science fiction story because it was in the Martello Tower, which was like a spaceship. And I made it that they were traveling, you know, because it's just one day. It's just the occurrence that happens on June 6th. And I got an A minus on it, but I feel ashamed of this. I wanted to graduate with high honors, and it was just holding me back a little bit. So I went and begged the teacher to raise it to an A. And he goes, I don't give a shit. Sure, I'll give you an A. And I felt like that. But I did graduate with high honors simply because of that. But yeah, even then, it was so funny because when I read what the kid was reading, I thought, wow, this is, it fits in perfectly with my life. But then, like, when you talk about, say, sampling the algorithms, it's kind of like you're stepping outside. Frequently, you step outside of this virtual world, go back into real space, and the people that are virtual realize that they only exist because they're able to tweak certain algorithms. Mm-hmm. So you're going in and out of this stuff, which is like, normally I would say it's breaking the fourth wall. And at one point you specifically do, but there really isn't a fourth wall.
Yeah, because I will, it's where it's like a series of cues. Like box number one is what we're in right now, you and I. My box number two is the book itself. Box number three is the contrived world of the book. Box number four is the world inside the world of the book. Box number five are the different planets inside the world of the world of the world of the book that I'm holding that we're talking about right now. And that's sort of what I wanted to get at. And even though, I mean, that's always like the question, like, do you want to go to outer space? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Well, whatever I said, you can go to outer space, but it's not going to be you. It's going to be a recording of you I made that could interact with the world the way you would. Would you feel satisfied by that? And so some people, it's like, yo, if it's me out there, sure. Even though I won't remember it because I'm down here. And so that kind of tension and struggles that I've always been playing with for years in different stories. And those, that's kind of like the apex of that. Like, how real is real? And if I'm a perfect copy of myself and I'm experiencing things, am I really experiencing them or not? So it has that kind of Philip Dickian philosophical sort of thing going as well. And yeah. Science fiction story that we say, oh, here's things that aren't possible, but I'm going to believe them for the sake of a story. And real space inside the book, like real space stories inside the book, are what's actually happening in the real world outside of the skin of the spaceship. There's no more Earth and no more people. So that has become their fantasy, what real space was, used to be.
Yeah, I recently interviewed three hard science authors who were writing about the science of consciousness. And one of the things I asked each of them is, what if we're living in a solipsistic universe? And they got really pissed off because, of course, their books would be meaningless and one of us wasn't even there. And it was like really irritating to all three of them that I would even posit such a thing. Which reminds me, and I really, you know, I'm blabbing on and on, but why don't you tell the story of that part of the book where the planet breaker goes to the restaurant and there's that couple there and he tries to avoid the fight by asking if they want more breadsticks. Just tell a little bit. That's a good segment to tell about because it messes up everything.
Yeah. So there's more than one planet breaker. There's a lot of virtual worlds inside the spaceship, and there are a lot of planet breakers who are making their business to get rid of worlds they don't like. And the planet breaker has this kid with him on vacation to this world where everything goes perfectly smoothly. But then a couple of things don't, and a couple of angry planet breakers get very upset that something has not gone smoothly in the middle of a restaurant. And if you've ever been to a restaurant, you've met this couple. You've met these people like, oh, it's so cold in here. Oh, this, look at this fork. You call this a breadstick? And it always drives me crazy. Personally, because I have tinnitus, I have bad ears. So I always hear ringing in my ears, and the ear compensates for this by raising the volume. So I always hear conversations across a room when I'm in a restaurant, and I can't hear the person in front of me, but I can hear people off to the side complaining. So when I go to a restaurant, I'm surrounded by people who are complaining constantly, and I can't talk to the person in front of me. And I just thought, this has to go in the book. This horrifying experience I have every time I walk into a restaurant, which I have not in a year because of the plague, but in times past, where everyone just can't be satisfied for 25 minutes to eat their spaghetti without complaining, and one day they're going to go crazy and kill everybody. And so that happens. So I worked out the entire planet. And this leads to the planet breaker sort of throwing his son into space, hoping that somebody can save him from the planet being destroyed, and he ends up in the black hole where his grandparents live.
The only difference is they don't turn red hot. I mean, But it's nice the way they ask about whether he's, is your son going to be all right being left upstairs all alone?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, you know, how do I explain that? Am I being a bad parent or a good parent, you know? Because he is, you know, that's the other thing. Why don't you talk about that? You think he's a, first you think the kid's mother is a good mother.
Yeah, the kid's mother is a good mother.
Well, but then she's kind of like not beating him, but three times she kind of trashed him in a way. And the Planet Breaker brings that up. But
the mother is a better parent than the father. Let's put it that way. No one's perfect, right? Even in a virtual world, nobody's perfect. But the father is kind of a bad father.
Yeah. And you've met those people too. Like, and you can talk about it. Like when he says he's happy, talk about the way he's, you know, that kind of thing.
You know, this is what happens when you have a kid, and I have a kid, and he's 7 years old, and so some of the book is working out my own issues with the kid, I guess. So it's like that science fiction question people ask in science fiction, oh, where do you get your ideas? And in literary fiction, they always ask, so is this book autobiographical? And these are the same questions, right? Oh, yeah, one's just a subset of the other question. And so, yeah, there have been experiences where, you know, when you were a kid and your parents are unhappy, you try to make them happy. And when you're a parent, you don't want, if you're a good parent, or at least a decent parent, you don't want your kid to feel responsible for your happiness. So you say, oh, I'm absolutely happy. This is the happiest I've ever been. When you're miserable. And so I thought that was something worth putting in a book.
Yeah, it's funny because, well, again, without spoiling anything, when you have the son kind of with the son, and you use the word, which I found really fascinating, you use the word reticulated.
Yeah.
And I always think of that in a certain snake-like sense. But, okay, what about reticulation is so, again, I'm behind the curve. But what is that like in the virtual worlds that you live in from time to time?
I was actually thinking when I was talking about reticulation about books I read as a kid, a lot of books when I had, was a kid had there's a fashion for reticulated covers, where there'd be some image on the cover, and you turn the cover, you angle it slightly, and the image change. And so the reticulation is this. Image one is this, image two is this, and when you shift, one becomes more prominent over the other. And it just reminded me of my childhood reading these books with reticulated covers, and I thought, oh, that'd be a great word to use to describe the kid going back and forth between the ages of 7 and 14. To explain every detail of this book, when he's stuck in the black hole, time stops on the event horizon. So he enters the black hole at 7, he lives a few minutes later at 14, and because it's a virtual world, that creates a bug, so he goes back between 7 and 14 constantly. And one issue the parents have is how do we resolve this problem for a kid? And so reticulation does seem fun on that level of reminding me of me being 7 years old, looking at these books where you flip them back and forth and see different things happening. And of course, any parent who's even a decent parent, not much less a good parent, wants their kid to grow up, but also misses the kid when they're young. And so I felt like a way to do that at the same exact time by having him be 7 and 14, having him be a little bratty kid and an obnoxious teenager and a sweet little boy and a charming young man. And then I wanted to focus on sons because you, as a bookstore owner, you know that every third book is the something or his daughter, right?
Oh, yeah. Or
yeah. Girl, the something or his girl. It's time for a boy book. So the Planet Breaker son, that name came first before all of this. And then everything else just drifts out of, yeah, we'll throw in Arabi. We'll throw in what you think the book covers. We'll throw in my experience of 30 years on the internet. We'll throw in my crabby opinions about space travel. We'll throw in the Greek gods because that's what came out of it.
It's funny because I can tell you, again, not to go over too long because it pisses me off myself, is at my age, which I don't think I am, it's when I was a kid, everyone would say, enjoy every moment, or like Warren Zevon said, enjoy every sandwich. You know, you don't think about that. And when I was a kid, told me, just enjoy it because it's going to go really fast. Mm-hmm. And I didn't believe at all. And then it started going really fast. And what they don't tell you is it goes faster and faster and faster. So
yeah,
the reticulation you're talking about is, I can remember my son exactly when he's 3 years old, and exactly the things we did, which were this giant crystal came down from space in the night, and we'd go out in the morning in the garden, and there's this crystal, and we'd have this story about, and he believed it all. And now my son's 40. He's 40 years old, but I was just throwing him up in the air when he was three. And both of those things in my mind existed exactly at the same time. And it will happen to you too.
Sure, it's already happening. I mean, I get, thanks to Facebook, I get a memory of my kid every morning of when he was two. And now he's seven. And I keep showing him. I said, hey, you remember this? You remember that dog? You remember your grandmother who died? Nope, none of it. Ah, well, here it is on Facebook. And so I'm already experiencing that. Thanks to the internet, it's even faster now. And of course, it's going to get faster.
Yeah, and
so
I know.
That is what the book is about.
Yeah, who knows what it's going to be like. Hey, do you like Greek coffee?
No, I don't drink coffee at all, actually. I'm a super taster. I hate bitter things. My father likes Greek and Turkish coffee. So he does drink little cups constantly of it.
Right, that's true. And your the Planet Breakers father's mother is also making Greek. You know, I love, you know, in my bookstore, I serve coffee. And after I read this book, I started looking up the stuff you need to make Greek coffee. And I just texted this morning my manager saying, hey, let's start serving Greek coffee.
So, oh, fantastic.
I know. So if we do, it's because of you. Excellent. And then the other thing is, when you throw Athena into the mix, I was thinking, you know, Athena springs full blown from the head of Zeus. And I was thinking, hey, that's kind of like the book. It's kind of like, yeah, you have this thing and then this other thing comes out of it, but it's not the thing anymore.
Right.
It's hard to explain this shit. It's hard to
just
talk
read the book.
About.
I mean, the experience of the book is, I guess what I'm trying to do is have a science fiction book that is originally hard science fiction. Again, the math is probably all wrong, but I made an effort. That is also a domestic drama. That is also frack-related and postmodern. That is also short, so I can't spend a lot of time explaining things in the book. But I do just have to sort of dive in it and depend on your cultural knowledge of Greek gods and how science fiction works and what kids are about. And so I want that experience. I mean, I always try to write short books that you can read in one sitting and have one weird experience and think about it afterward. So my books don't wrap up at the end. They just sort of blow out at the end. And I hope they stay with the reader. And as far as the return, you know, things change a lot. I mean, my grandfather was a blacksmith.
Really?
You know, he was literally the blacksmith of the village. And, you know, he was a 20th century figure. He died when I was in the fourth grade. It wasn't that long, but you know, the part of Greece my parents are from was like a very primitive part of Greece. Very backward area. Not politically, but like technologically. Like my father grew up with an outhouse. And now I've got, you know, I can take a poop on an airplane. Something my grandfather would never have done in his life. When my grandmother got a phone, she got a phone in her 70s. She got rid of it after a month. She's like, I didn't realize you had to pay for it twice. I thought you'd have free calls from now on. So this is the kind of thing where in my family life, I've gone from 17th, 18th century to advanced 21st century over the course of a generation.
Yeah, it's so funny because, like, I have my uncle.
Yeah, he's had
my uncle. Sorry.
Good.
My Uncle Joe died in 1993, so I inherited his old black rotary phone made out of Bakelite, and someone had kindly taken the cord and turned it into an RJ11 so you could plug it in. It still has better sound quality than any phone I've ever used since. Isn't that strange?
It is. It's amazing. And it happens all the time. I mean, if you look at photography, the daguerreotype photographs that are printed on glass have resolution beyond any screen you own. You can zoom in and see, you know, the hairs on someone's knuckles in a properly lit 19th century photograph. Because the resolution is amazing. And since then, we haven't improved resolution, we've improved speed of processing. So now we can all be little Ansel Adams with our telephones. But we can't capture that same level of detail that the original photographs done on glass plates have. So
here's an interesting question, or at least I think it's interesting. I remember when cars for like 5 years, they had digital speedometers, so you could see exactly the speed you were going. but it went away because people want analog. They want to see where they've been and where they're going. Same thing with my radio in my car. I don't want to press a button that takes me from 97.1 to 97.3. I want to turn the knob so I can catch everything that's in between. Is there, no pun intended, an analog between the analog and the digital sense of the word in your consciousness and the consciousness of your contemporaries? I mean, when you write this stuff, is there a way that you can distinguish between the analog world and the digital world, especially in the concept you've created here?
Well, it's all about information. So the information you get from that digital readout tells you exactly your speed, but it doesn't tell you your acceleration. Right? Exactly. When you can see the needle go fast, you know your acceleration. It gives you implicit knowledge, implicit information. And the same with ebooks. You know, I have ebooks. I've got a Kindle. I've got my telephone. I read ebooks sometimes. I often prefer print books, not just because I was raised with them, but because I can tell how close I am to done. When I have a thick book, I can just sense, aha, half of it's in this hand, half of it's in this hand. I know halfway through. With digital, I never quite sure. Even if it gives me a percentage point, I'm not quite sure what a page looks like. Between Kindle and the telephone, I'm not quite sure where I am. And so I tend to only read nonfiction or short fiction pieces on the phone, and anything that's substantive, I have to read in my hand because I get more information from how it feels in my hands and around my fingers than I do from looking at the readouts and the information that Kindles give me by pointing out what percentage I'm in, how many hours I have left, whether something's a 10-minute read or a 5-minute read. And of course, for me, it's a 2-minute read or 5-minute because I read faster than the person that they use to determine this. And so, yeah, the analog world and the digital world slam up against each other all the time. Why is vinyl making a comeback? Why is VHS making a comeback?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It's more fun to rewind a VHS tape than it is to run your mouse across the bottom of the screen to make things go fast. You know, and VHS loads faster.
Right? True.
If I scroll if I'm watching a YouTube video and go to the middle of it, depending on my speed of my Wi-Fi or my connection, it'll stop, it'll pause, it'll make a little circle that drives me crazy. But physically moving something across a helical scan of a magnetic tape means I have the feeling that I'm actually doing something.
Yeah, it's funny. I wonder how much time in your life you and I have spent looking at a spinning circle of multicolors if you're using a Mac.
I have so many fantasies of like after the revolution, grabbing all these software engineers and putting them in the gulag and saying, fix this. Especially now with I work in publishing again, and I'm writing a book and talking to people. And I thank God I live alone. Just screaming, no! An hour a day, it just happens over and over again. I shut down my computer, it drives me up the wall. I'm losing years of my life to this circle.
Yeah, it actually is years. You know, there's charts that tell you how many years it's taken you to tie your shoes in your lifetime and all that. Exactly. Of course, now you don't tie your shoes.
In this circle, yeah.
But, you know, it's funny what you're saying about the book, because when I got the PDF first, and then when Angie at the bookstore showed me the book, all these books are thin. And when I got the digital book, I thought, okay, well, it's going to be like a George R.R. Martin book, or it's going to be like whatever. You know, it's a mass market book. You can't even open it and read it. But yeah, then so then when I saw it, I got a really kind of real concrete feel of what this book is going to be. Yes, I'll be able to read it in one sitting. It's going to be really cool. I love the cover. None of that came through. I'm getting a PDF that kind of jumbles together things. And sure. Yeah, it was a completely different feel, just like you explained. Yeah, exactly. I was going to ask you something. Let me look at it if I can find it. Oh, yeah. When you talk about how things like hydrogen 7.
Yeah.
It actually is the heaviest isotope of hydrogen. And you stick it in there. But then I found out it's also the name of a BMW prototype car. I don't know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Neither did I. But I knew about the isotope.
You know, coincidences happen.
Yeah, so you stick that in there, and then so the reader thinks, if the reader is conversant enough to know, okay, why is it the heaviest isotope of hydrogen that needs to be included in the story to make things work? You know? And how do you choose? Okay, like A Rose for Emily is another one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you add in there that obviously these things, yeah, I would never ask. I've never asked, is this book autobiographical or simply like they do on Good Morning America? What's your book about? That one's the worst. But yeah, so all these references, literary and otherwise, allusions, it sounds like you're admitting freely that they all come from stuff going on with you.
To a certain extent, sure, but also things I've seen from other people and things you create to make the world work and the like. And so something like Hydrogen 7 being the name of a car prototype happens to me all the time. My first novel was about Jack Kerouac. I wrote him as a character. He's Jack Kerouac in a Lovecraftian malefic universe where he's trying to save the world from Lovecraftian monsters. And after I finished it, before I published it, I told a friend, saying, oh, I wrote about Jack Kerouac. He saves the world. I was like, oh, how did she do that? He was a pacifist. I said, oh, my God, I better go back and rewrite this book. And so I read the book again and said, wait a minute, he doesn't do anything like that. I just happen to know Kerouac well enough from having read his books and his letters that whenever he has a gun in his hand or is about to fight, he runs away or throws a gun down, thinks about something else. So I coincidentally got it right that he was a pacifist.
Well, you know, it's like when you talk about not South American, but Latin American magical realism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're moving on now in terms of the way the book moves. We're moving on to a different story. Well, go ahead first and tell how the book is divided up, because we talked a little bit about this at the beginning and before we started. So how is your book divided up? Because each one of these books has that kind of division.
Yeah, so every outspoken author book is actually a collection. Short fiction, one piece of which is new. A work of nonfiction, that say an essay, often essay about a literary topic or political topic, pardon me. And then a Q&A with Terry Bisson, the series editor. And so since I am not as famous as Ursula K. Le Guin or anyone else involved in the series so far, I wrote a novella, which takes up most of the book. There's another short piece of short fiction in there called Ring, 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 which was published a couple of years ago. It is based on the settings and characters of Geoffrey Thomas, a fantasist of some renown, who mostly publishes in small presses and specialty presses, but like where sea monsters come from, the idea of the sea serpent and the sea monster, where they think it comes from now. It comes from drunken sailors seeing whales' penises breaking through the waves as the whales would swim by. And so they see this weird snake-like thing emerge. And so that's what Geoffrey Thomas is like. He's had a couple books with major publishers. That's like the whale's penis. You think is a sea monster, but it's something even more amazing underneath the waves. And so he's written frequently about Punktown, this planet that has all sorts of weird species and magic and gonzo technology. And I worked for him because I liked him. In a setting that came out a couple years ago, that we printed that there. And because there's no real way to make a junkie living writing fiction anymore. Like, there's no more pornographic novels. There's no more quick 6-week paperback. I started funding my early term paper. And so there's an essay about my years of the term paper, which has been reprinted in textbooks for writing term papers and got me called a whore and infer once. So that's been a pretty famous essay that's also it's also in the book.
It's funny, you know, you can't steal your term paper from the internet now because all your professors have that program that allows you to find it, but you can still have someone write it for you. That's the analog part of it, because they're not plagiarizing, because those words have never come out of anybody else's mouth until that moment.
Yeah, you're like a Cyrano de Bergerac. Instead of giving love poetry, you're just giving what Hamlet was about.
Yes, you can just whisper in somebody's ear using, yeah, exactly. Ring, 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 and then the third piece.
Is that essay? And then there's
the... Oh, yeah, right. Oh. Was there, like, the Q&A in there, like, interview part?
Yeah. I hope so. Isn't here?
Yeah, I might not have had it in the PDF, or I missed it after the acknowledgments or something.
Oh, it's in the middle. It's called, here you go. I'm going to hold it up to you like you can read it in here.
Okay.
The Q&A does exist. It's real.
Okay. So I read it, but in my mind, I incorporated it into something else, which, according to you, I'm allowed to do, right?
Absolutely. That's the point of the book. Yeah.
Oh, talk about, again, because some of our guys and women and my demographic won't know, but talk a little bit, because you just mentioned it, about ASMR and what that is and how it's kind of not ubiquitous, but it's become an incredible meme, if you will.
Sure. So ASMR is a phenomenon that people experience or they don't. And ASMR is sort of a semi-scientific name for autonomic sensory meridian response. It basically means when you hear certain noises or get certain kinds of attention that you feel physiologically very good, like you start tingling or you feel very relaxed. The classic example is Bob Ross, the old painter from PBS. And people loved Bob Ross because he had such a soothing voice. And you have to hear the scraping of the, because he used the knife a lot to move the paint around. You'd hear that scraping sound. And some people just found the relaxing policy. Some people found it almost orgasmic. And so now there's a huge YouTube subculture of ASMR artists who do things like they'll tell you about their day or read a book to you, or which I dislike, but pretend to be like, you're like a doctor and say, oh, hey, Sam, how's it going? Let me just pluck that out of there. How you feeling? You know, that kind of thing. And they wear weird costumes, and they have these things. They might be 3 hours long. Some of them are highly inexplicable. If you don't have ASMR, you have no idea why. There's an hour-long video of somebody ironing a shirt. But if you have ASMR, it's like, yes, this is the one I want. And that shirt. And you just love it. Other people are driven crazy by it. People really hate it. You know, sort of like an annoying sound. Like sometimes if you're, you know, on a train or something, someone's doing this. And they're having fun with it. Like, yeah, I'm flipping through. I'm just idling away. But you're sitting next to them, it drives you crazy. So ASMR is a very unusual phenomenon. I have it. I experienced it when I came across it actually by hearing somebody whisper reading to the Odyssey on YouTube. Oh, does that work? I said, oh, what's a whisper reading? Let me click on this. They read the Nausicaa, that section of the Odyssey. I was like, well, this is an amazing, this is the best Odyssey I've ever heard in my life. And I was just sitting there at work, my eyes rolling back in my head. And then I figured out what ASMR was and started finding all these videos.
And there's so many things that, like, I bought my partner's daughter, she's 13, I bought her an Oculus. And then I used the Oculus for like 15 minutes. And my neck started hurting, and Lorelai goes, watch out, you're going to step into that, you're going to walk right over that chair. And I was completely in this other world. And then the other thing is so weird is, like, I had this nonfiction book club. And all, you know, it's, I don't know why book clubs are always women. I was the only guy. I was a moderator. And they're all like 55 or 60, which is still younger than me. And I just thought, okay, I'll ask them, how many of you know what TikTok is? Not one. How many of you know what a meme is? Not one. And I'm thinking, you know, it's like Nancy Pelosi talking about Bitcoin. She has no idea.
Yeah.
And so it's like me going to YouTube and finding scenes of Denzel Washington in The Equalizer and watching them over and over again, or Tom Brady mic'd up for the Super Bowl. And I'm looking up stuff for you, but YouTube knows what I want to watch. So it sends me there. And all this stuff is like, I guess what my point is all this stuff is no different than what you're doing. That's what's so scary. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. All speculative writers now, when they're writing about the near future, I always realize it's not the near future, it's now.
Exactly. You're writing with the present. And even then, you know, it takes a couple of years to write a book. Like, I've been writing this book that's going to come out in November, The Second Shooter, since 2016, on and off. And I keep having to update it because things keep changing. And of course, now I'm finishing up while COVID is happening. So do I put COVID in the book? Do I hint that it's going to happen?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm still working. I'm throwing in a little bit here and there. And I see all this with a great book I read recently by Elizabeth Hand, who's also an outspoken author. She's in the series. She wrote a book called The Book of Lamps and Banners, one of her crime novels. And it came out, you know, late last year, I suppose. So COVID happened during the production process, and I suspect without evidence that the few sentences about people wearing masks and that virus from China and here and there that are put in while she's trying to solve this crime were put in during layout to make it seem ultra contemporary. Because otherwise it would feel a little old fashioned already.
Yeah, I know. And the other thing that people of a certain age can't possibly understand is like the YouTube video of you with the moderator and you're sitting at the desk and everyone is cross-legged on their sabadons. And you're there with your mask. You're the only one wearing a mask, too.
That's right, yeah.
and then I watch him, and he's taking his arm, and he's moving it down, and he's got Pac-Man across his shirt. And I realize that other people between the ages of 8 and 19 are just looking at this as real. And I'm looking at it as like, wow, this is amazing they can do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be this switch, kind of like at the end of the end game or something, where half of us are kind of disintegrated and the other half remain.
Yep. It's already happening with my kid. He likes to play Roblox on TV, on the iPad, I should say.
Yeah. I'm
already...
Which
he loves Roblox. I know the games very well. I understand how the games work. I, you know, grew up with video games myself, but I can't play any of them. I'm terrible at it because I don't know how to move my thumb the right way. So my character's always crying or that kind of thing, and I have no knack for it. Now my kid can't use a camera, but he can play Roblox really well.
I know, it's like Lorelai is coding in Minecraft. She's been playing Minecraft since she's 4. She's gonna be able to code without even going to college. And my son, the 40-year-old son, he basically can live inside of Excel. I can't use Excel. And
I can't use it.
He can live inside Excel while he's typing in 100 words a minute, looking at me and talking. And I'm thinking, that's impossible. It literally is impossible.
Absolutely.
So that's not the near future. That's now.
Exactly. We're already divided.
So that's an interesting thing now. It's like when Trump was president, and unfortunately maybe again, it's like, you know, you look at Stephen Colbert or Jimmy Fallon or Jimmy Kimmel, and they're attempting to satirize him. And just like in science fiction, you can't satirize something like that.
Yeah, you say, here he is, baby, and he does it himself.
Yes.
So he's like a semi-automatic satirist.
Yeah, but you see that happening in a similar fashion, once again, in an analogy situation with science fiction, or with whatever you want to call what you write?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's definitely a challenge to satirize something when the real world beats you to it. So the second shooter is about mass shooting events and conspiracy theories. And now, of course, while I'm writing it, conspiracy theories have become incredibly dangerous with, say, QAnon and COVID denying and anti-vaccine sentiments and these kinds of things. And it becomes weird. It's like, and I'm thinking about this while I'm writing this book, am I doing the right thing by writing about conspiracy theories? Not that I think my books are so influential that they're going to make people believe in them or that kind of thing, but the question becomes, how can I make a book about this entertaining and interesting and say something that's not just obvious that you can't get from the newspaper? And so this is one reason why the book is due November 1st. It's what, March 10th? It'll be done soon, I promise you, editor. It's only been 5 months. Maybe one more month, I'll figure it out.
I know, and then you got to worry about, now you have to worry about whether it's going to be offensive, like poor Dr. Seuss, you know?
Oh, I don't.
It's like,
you know, so, and you know, that Dr. Seuss, you can still get it in the library, and of course, I was having this conversation on Twitter the other day. There was a public intellectual saying that we should limit a copyright to 30 years, because otherwise, you know, you get these things trapped, and you can't get the stuff from the authors don't want to give it to you. And my thought was, look, if you want racist caricatures, you can draw them yourself and publish them yourself anytime on Kindle in 2 seconds. You don't need the Dr. Seuss estate to help you. And that did not go over well with him. But no, I'm not super worried about being canceled or anything, honestly. There's a partially because I'm not widely read enough.
that's a really... That's a really lousy excuse. Yeah. Well, even though I'm not known well enough, I can certainly offend people on a daily basis. It's easy. Sure. Well, you know, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I was just thinking about the fact that this is such a, you know, I don't want to say public service, but this whole series, and I don't, how long is it going to go on? They're just going to keep cranking them out. You were the last one, and now you're third from the last.
That's right. They do two a year, and they'll keep doing it as long as, I won't say as long as it keeps selling, because who knows how long it sells, but they're cheap to do. Right? How do you get an Ursula K. Le Guin book in your list for a couple thousand dollars? Well, you print one of her flash fictions and some reprints, and you beg and beg and beg, and it works.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, with me, is I do have the luxury, after a long career, of being able to get whatever I want, and if they don't like it, it's too bad. So
yeah,
just the idea of having these in a shelf all in a line just gives me this ASMR feeling.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a completist too. I was happy to be 26 because I had the first 25, and I get them the day they come out, and I read the interview, and then I read the stories, and it's always great. And libraries do this too. I mean, a lot of these books sell to public libraries because once you put a number on a spine, the library is kind of committed to getting every number.
I know, but it's like the Wimpy Kid series. Any kid who comes into my bookstore, whichever Wimpy Kid they want is the one that I don't have.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy. The other thing I wanted to tell you before I left was, so I figured I'm going to be really cool. I'm going to look up numerology and see what the number 26 means and if it's akin to you. So I looked it up, and it's totally opposite of you. It's realism, family I got, business, teamwork, diplomacy, efficiency, material, and accumulative.
Yeah, definitely not accumulating a lot of stuff. Look how I live. Nor am I diplomatic, nor efficient, that's for sure.
Well, anyway, like I said, it was a pleasure talking to you, and thanks so much for being a part of this series, and the series itself, as I said, is excellent. And now, and the other thing that's really cool about it, now that you get a taste of someone, like in these brief introduction books I have, now I can go back and look at your entire oeuvre, you know?
That's the hope.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. All right, well, thanks
again. So much. My pleasure as well.
See ya.
Dave.